I was going to just say one thing, is that when we have a baptism for somebody as young and vibrant as Ryan, the contrast, I know that if you're visiting with this family, you know, the contrast is the color of her hair versus the color of most of other people's hair. And if we seem a little overly excited, it's because we are so thankful to have all of our members, but especially our members under a certain age. And I wanted to share a story with you. At a church I was pastoring before, I was told by one of the young families of why they took their teenage daughters to another school and why they took them to the Sunday school class at this larger, younger church across town. And she said the reason was that in youth, when the youth group got together, and somebody made a decision like Ryan has, made a decision for Christ, they said her youth cheered. You know, they cheered that decision. They loved that decision. So I just want to let you know that this church today, I am proud of you all. You cheered Ryan's decision today. I know a lot of it came from up here. But I am proud how much of it came from back there. It was very un-Adventist-like, and I'm so proud of you. Every now and then I have to, you know, when we rejoice and we do it with a particular volume, usually an Adventist, and I hear Lutherans are this way too, but an Adventist and Lutheran just kind of have to apologize for that. And I thank you for not apologizing. Heaven's a loud place, don't you understand that? Heaven is a loud place. It is going to be loud, very loud. That's why it's so weird, it's so strange that heaven falls silent for a half hour just before the second coming. You know why? Because every other minute, since eternity, it's been a very loud place. 24 elders praising and thousands and thousands of angels praising and everything else. And I always try to tell anyone I baptize, wouldn't you like to listen close enough to hear it? Because Jesus says that when just one comes back, the Lord rejoices and all heaven rejoices, you know. So I'm proud of you, church. Let's get louder. If we can't hear heaven, let's let them hear us. No, so thank you. Thank you for today. And the Harlan family, thank you for the privilege to allow us to share in Ryan's moment, in your moment. And thank you for that. We're moving on in the letter to the Galatians. And I knew I had to get to this point. It's one of my favorite points, is because to talk about a few things that we in the Western world may not quite understand. And I've always found it very, very helpful to understand these principles when it comes to Bible study. We don't realize, not many people know, that our Bibles, you know, are broken up into these two huge sections, and we know they're broken up even more than that, but we have what has to me derogatorily been termed as the Old Testament. I don't like saying the Old Testament because old implies that it's not useful anymore. We live in a society that once something becomes new, whatever it replaced. And I'm here to tell you the New Testament did not replace the Old Testament. The New Testament is a further fulfillment, a going on. And that is one of the concepts behind Hebrew thought. When most people hear the word Hebrew, what do you think of? You think of a language, right? You think of the language in which Jews speak. And there's modern Hebrew and there's ancient Hebrew. There's biblical Hebrew. There's the Masoretic text. And there's all kinds of Hebrew. But the thing about Hebrew is that it's not a language. It's a way of thinking. It's a philosophy. Most Western thought is formed, if you will, by the Western thinkers, what we consider the Western thinkers, the Greek philosophers. Most Western thought is very Platonic, Socratic. Hebrew thought, I believe, came before. And Hebrew thought, in a lot of ways, is absolutely opposite of Western thought. So Hebrew has a particular, somebody who's, so the language then reflects that way of thinking. The language actually was formed after the action. Hebrew is a language of action, if you will. All the verbs come first. All the verbs come first. And the nouns are then derived from the verbs. And if you think about it, creation is a very Hebrew event, if you will. God acts first. God acts first, and then he tells the creation to think about it. Western thought says, I think, therefore I what? I am. Hebrew thought says, no, God acted, and you get to think. Right? Because the very first thing God ever did was act. And then the words come to describe it. And in the Old Testament, if you will, and I'm going to refer to it as the Hebrew Scriptures, it's mostly written in Hebrew, and that's why, you know, what we think. And the reason it's written in Hebrew is not just because that's the language that God's children spoke from, we're not sure, okay, from we're not sure, but at least from the 6th century B.C. on, but we're not 100% sure. But not only is that, but it describes God as a God of action, as a God of moving. And there's a bunch of Hebrew principles that I believe help us understand the New Testament a whole lot better if we understand these principles. To me, the best way to give an example to a church is that most of us have seen Fiddler on the Roof. Fiddler on the Roof is a very Hebrew musical. And there's not that many Hebrew words spoken or sung in Fiddler on the Roof. It's all done in what? It's all done in English, okay? But the concepts, what you see happening. And the thing about it is, I want you to understand two principles. Is that Hebrew thought says, you know what? A child of Abraham, as Ed was reading to us today, for some reason, God has selected these people, this group of people. Were they the greatest in number? No, Deuteronomy says they were the least in number. Were they the most important of all peoples? He said, no, they were the least important. Then why were they chosen? Deuteronomy says, because God loved you. That action of God loving. And if you're going to believe that the covenant given through Abraham now belongs to all of Abraham's children, okay, then the action of that covenant is completely shown. They began to formalize. You know what? You know what God really did was that he really kind of backed himself into a corner, didn't he? He tells Abram, your children shall remain for how long? Forever. Your descendants will remain forever. So in a Hebrew mindset, God, what he did as the creator of the universe, he kind of backed himself into a corner and he self-limited his sovereignty based on these children. If they don't live forever, is God really God? So in a way, and there's no blasphemy about this. They take God at his word. They have faith enough that if God said it, then we should live this way. And the way they picture it is that they picture it as they become partners in the covenant. And that's what a covenant was supposed to be. Earthly covenants were not made that way. Earthly covenants were made where all one had all the power, and the covenant he makes with someone who doesn't have power is to assure that that person never gets this power. God's covenant was different. God's covenant was, is that we're partners in this, Abram, and as long as your children remain forever, then I will be the God of the covenant. And you see that in Fiddler on the Roof. Tevye is a very astute rabbi. In fact, Tevye is one of my favorite rabbis, even though he's not the rabbi in Fiddler on the Roof. He's just an elder. But you know how the scene opens? The scene opens. Tevye is walking his lame horse back to the barn. It's about 3 hours before sundown on Sabbath, and he actually has more milk deliveries to make. And he's bemoaning that as he walks. It's 3 hours till sundown on Sabbath. I still have more deliveries, and the horse is now lame. I've got to go back to my barn. I've got to unhitch him. I've got to put a good horse on the cart, and I've got to make the rest of the deliveries all before sundown. And when he gets to the gate, just before he opens the gate, he's walking with that horse, and the horse is like right here. And he stops, and he looks at the horse, and he looks up at the sky, and he goes, was this really necessary? love that. Because who is he talking to? He's talking to his partner. Right? That's not a fearful servant of an angry God. That's a partner. Somebody who could question his sovereignty at that moment. Was this really necessary? And if you look, it's one of the first qualities you recognize in Abram right off the bat. Right? Because God says, shall I reveal to Abram what I'm about to do? And Abram hears what he's about to do, and Abram begins to negotiate with him. He begins to question God's sovereignty at that moment. You understand that Tevye is not an ant. He's not a worm. He's a partner at this moment. And he also then, in the song, everybody knows the song that he sings next? My favorite song from Fiddler on the Roof is If I Were a Rich Man. The principle that If I Were a Rich Man is the standard principle. It's one of the first principles you learn in Judaic studies. The principle of Kal Vachomer. Kal Vachomer. The argument from the greatest to the least. Or some would say the argument from the least to the greatest. And in that song, you know the refrain. If I were a rich man. Why would it upset this huge cosmic plan that you have, Lord, if I were only a rich, rich man? In other words, you're the ruler of the universe. You have everything. You have a cattle on 1,000 hills. Silver and gold are like pavement to you. Would it really, really upset the entire apple cart of the universe if one poor Russian Jew was rich? The principle of Kal Vachomer, the argument of the least to the greatest. And that argument is put forward in Jesus' teaching every time he opens his mouth. If a little bird, a little brown bird, which is everywhere, which sells for half a penny, doesn't fall to the ground outside your Father's care, how much more will he care for you? The argument of the least to the greatest. The argument of Kal Vachomer. And you see it everywhere in Jesus' teaching. And some people would say, well, the New Testament isn't written in Hebrew, Pastor Greg. It's written in what? It's written in Greek. Yes, but it was Hebrews that wrote it. Which shows you it's not the language, it's the way that they think. It's the way that they solve problems. It's the way that they worship. It's the way that they view God. So every time that I teach that principle, I say, you know what? We all need to be a bit more Jewish than we are. Because I think Western thought sometimes detracts away from proper Bible interpretation, I believe. If we begin to think a little bit more like Hebrews, I think we'd be a lot better off. I love that line. Was this really necessary? So, remember last week what we concluded? Why was Abraham right before God? Why was he righteous? What made Abraham righteous? We talked about this in prayer meeting. That's what we get to do in prayer meeting. If you got problems, and I know a lot of you do, but if you got problems with the sermon, you bring them to me in prayer meeting. We'll talk about it, okay? Tell me I'm wrong. I've been told before, and I'll be told again. But we go a little further. We talk about it in prayer meeting. That word righteous, that Abraham was righteous because he believed, okay? What that literally means is that he was made absolutely right before God. He was absolutely right before God. And what Paul is concluding, telling the Galatians, that what made him righteous was what? His willingness to become circumcised? No, not at all. It was because he what? He believed. So he said, for this reason, those who believe are blessed with Abraham who believed. You haven't been with us. We're talking about a church that's been convinced that in order for them to be saved and to be children of Abraham, they need to become circumcised and they need to begin to observe particular laws, not Jewish laws. Not ceremonial laws, but the actual laws that came in the Hebrew Scriptures. They've adopted all of them, or tried to. And these distorters of the gospel, if you will, have convinced the Galatians that they need to do this. They need to, yes, believe, but they also need to uphold the law in order to be children of Abraham. And they convinced them that if you do this thing that Abraham did, this sign, this seal of the covenant, if you will, then you'll be okay. You'll be on the right track. Well, Paul is very upset that they've done this. Because Paul is saying, no, this is not what makes you children of Abraham. What makes you children of Abraham is if you have the faith of Abraham. Because when he says this to Abraham, Abraham has none. He's argued with God about who his descendants are going to be. And he tells him, he says, look, I will give you a child. And Abraham looks at himself, 100 years old. He looks at his wife, 90 years old, completely barren all her life. He knows there's absolutely nothing he can do to bring this about. But God says, I'm going to give you a child. And Abraham says, you know what? I believe you. God says, done. Sold. Righteous in my eyes, continue to walk with me and talk with me, my man. We cheered for Ryan, but not one amen there? Okay, that's all right. That's all right. So what Paul is telling them, that what makes you a child is not the physical sign. What makes you a child is that if you have the faith that Abraham had at that moment. And the moment that he had was that there was nothing he was going to be able to do. God said, I'll give you a child. Abraham may have even said in his head, you know what, that sounds absolutely crazy, but since you said it, I believe it. Right before God's eyes. Righteousness. Justified. Done. Transaction done. A covenant made only by the one who has the power to make the covenant. Who is the only one that can make right? The Creator, the Judge, the Messiah of all the universe is the only one that can make right. And he made Abraham right at that moment. So what Paul's argument back to this church who thinks that they can finish this covenant in the flesh by obedience to the law, he's saying, no, that is not what makes you a child of Abraham. What makes you a child of Abraham is that if you have the faith Abraham had. If you believe. Ryan acted on her belief today. God doesn't love Ryan because she decided to give her heart to him. God loved Ryan all along. God loved Ryan if she had never ever made this decision. Ryan heard it though, believed she's a daughter of Abraham today, right in God's eyes. So this is the conclusion that we had from last week. He says, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. In order that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles so that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. Jews and Gentiles, no more. We're going to get to that later in Galatians. Jews and Gentiles, no more. You're children of Abraham, not because you did what Abraham did, it's because you believe the way Abraham believed. It belongs to us all now. It belongs to us all. So it brings us to today. He says, brothers and sisters, there's a natural break there. He addresses them, and he changes the tone of the letter completely, because this is the first time he's called them this. And I think maybe he wants to get this point across without having the fact that he's called them fools twice now. And he's told them that they were victims of witchcraft, that they were hexed. Who has bewitched you? I think before he made this point, he wanted them to know something, that they were still his what? That they were still his brothers and his sisters. So there's a natural break here. He's going to tell us a little bit something more about Abraham. He's going to change it from the blessing and the spirit, if you will, or the faith, if you will. He's going to introduce them to a couple of new words. And he's going to do it using this rabbinic principle. And I'll point it out when he does. Okay? But he says, brothers and sisters, I give an example from daily life. Now, this is a modern translation of this. If you've got your King James Version out, it says speaking as a man or giving a human argument, if you will. This is a very good interpretation of that. Because what's happened is that the King James Version said that since literally says speaking as a man would speak, a lot of us have begun to argue, Christianity has argued for centuries now, for millennia now, that Paul was actually saying, I have the same authority as God. And that's not what he's saying at all. He's saying, what I want to do now is give you a human argument. I want to give you a human point. And this is a very good, I want to give an example from our daily lives. Are you with Paul? I want to give you an example of our daily lives. And he says, once a person's will has been ratified, no one adds to it or annuls it. So once somebody's will is put out there, and when I say will, it's not last will and testament, although it could be, because if you think about it, a will and a testament is a covenant, isn't it? It's an agreement that the person is saying, this is what's going to happen when I can no longer carry it out. The will is a covenant. Marriage is a covenant between two people. And what he's saying is once it's put out there and put into writing. Now, by the time Paul writes this, not everything may have been absolutely in writing, but they were getting there. They were getting there to where they were actually putting the covenants and contracts on paper, if you will. And he's saying this, he's saying, once it's been ratified, you can't change it. Only the person who they call it the testator. Is that right? Is that the old legal term? The one that puts the covenant out or the will out or the testator, the one that holds the power of the covenant, if you will. And he says, once it's been there, no one adds to it or what? Annuls it. Once that covenant was posted and it was signed, and it was ratified. He says, we can't change it. We absolutely can't change it. The best example I could give would be any loan that we've ever taken out. When we take out a loan, when we take out a mortgage, we usually agree to the terms, right? If we sign the papers, we've agreed to the terms. And what does it include? Monthly payment, length, right? The length of it, and the interest rate, right? Any of those things. After you've already signed those papers and you leave, you ever changed your mind and tried to change the covenant? Think your mortgage company is going to say, you know what? I've changed my mind. I don't like this interest rate. I'm only going to begin to pay this much every month. Sure, mortgage company is going to say, no sweat. Right? You see what Paul is saying? He says, if you can't do it with a human covenant, if you can't do it between a covenant made between me and Zach, he goes, then why would you think that God would do it? Do you hear Kal Vachomer right there? The argument from the what? From the greatest to the least. Or if you want to, the argument from the least to the greatest. If you can't do it with a human covenant, what makes you think you can do it with God's covenant? So you see where he's going with the Galatians, right? You see where he's going. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I'll give this land. So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. Where he's going with this is, look, you can't change or alter the covenant that God drew up in the first place. You can't do it. And what he will get at here is, look, okay, you signed that covenant before there was any talk about circumcision, about Sabbath, about food, about drink, about any of those things. You signed that covenant. You entered into that covenant of Abraham because you have the faith of Abraham. You believe that Christ Jesus did what he did for you, is doing what he'll do for you, and will always do what he will do for you. You signed that covenant before there was any discussion about what was to come next. And now you're trying to annul that covenant of faith with a covenant of law. You can't do it. You can't do it. And the argument comes back saying, well, wait a minute. But Paul, I'm not a child of Abraham. And if you go back and look at the covenant, the Lord said, to your offspring I'll give this land. That's what those teachers told us. We have to become children of Abram in order to inherit the land. And they told us that the land was a physical metaphor for the kingdom. And this is what we want. And Paul says, all right. But let me tell you something. As a rabbi, let me tell you something that I know. When he said, to your offspring I will give this land. And then Abram does what? He builds an altar and worships. Notice, God acts first, gives him the promise of the land, and then Abram does something. Because why? Because if he doesn't, God's going to take the covenant away? No, that's not what Abram believed. It's because he believed him. So Paul's saying it comes first. And Paul says, look, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. In Hebrew, it would be seed. How many have your King James Version? It says seed, doesn't it? Some say descendants, some say offspring. You know what the problem with the English word of that is? Is that when you think of offspring, how many do you think of? You don't think of one, do you? When you say descendants, and any scripture that translates it as descendants is saying the same thing. That's the one time that in the English they give it as plural. But do you know that in the Hebrew, that is singular? One. To you and your offspring. Now, I know that he didn't mean one, right? Because number one, Abraham didn't have just one son, did he? And do you think that he's talking about Isaac there? Kind of in a way, a lot of people have that he's talking about Isaac. But we could be talking about something much, much more. So get this. Paul's saying, look, I understand how you feel. And Paul says, you know what? I used to put all my stock in being a direct descendant of Isaac. I was born into the tribe of Benjamin, circumcised on the eighth day. He said, I used to put all my stock into that. He said, but you know, I've been working with you Gentiles now for 7 years. And I'm here to tell you that you are as much a child of Isaac as I am because of your faith. And he says, but even when Abraham wrote this, when Moses wrote this about Abram, it was supposed to be to your child, I will give this land. Singular. One. And you're thinking, okay, well, it can't be Isaac. Because Isaac lived and he what? And he died. Where's the forever inheritance? How is everybody blessed in that? It's because he introduced us to that new word, this new word that's coming. He says, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar there and appeared to him. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. I'll make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that no one can count the dust of the earth. Your offspring also can be counted. Every time he says offspring in there, it's singular. One, one, one. To your child I will give you. To your child, I will give you. To your child, I will give you. The promises. It's a new word. Gospel and blessing was used before. A new word today is promises. He promises that this is it. Back in 16, the promises are this. The promises are this. And then the argument comes, well, if it really is Isaac, the point is it isn't Isaac. You know, the first time that this happens, where we in Western thought have always translated it as children or descendants. You know, the very first time it happens is all the way back in the garden. After the fall, God comes to all three of his creatures, all standing there. He speaks to Satan first. And he tells Satan, he says, look, because you've done this, on your belly you shall go. There won't be any animal lower than you. Okay, on your belly you shall go. So obviously snakes didn't always, my worst nightmare are snakes crawling. And if snakes crawling down that low can give me a nightmare, imagine if they could fly. The argument from the least to the greatest. If slithering snakes can frighten you, imagine what a flying snake would do to you. Okay. And then he says this, he says, I will bring enmity. And enmity is translated as hatred. But actually what enmity is enmity is a form of hatred that makes an enemy. That's why it's spelled that way. It's an old English word but it doesn't quite translate into New English. But it's hatred, yes, but it's not just hatred. It's hatred that carries on. It's hatred that will make whatever or whoever I hate an enemy, an actual enemy, to put in opposition. And he says to Satan, he says, I'm going to bring enmity between your seed, and when he points at Satan, he says, your seed, it's plural, your offspring, your descendants, and her seed. And when he says it about Eve, it's one child. It's singular. So actually, literally what he told Satan that day is that one day, amongst all of your descendants, all of your children, there will enter in one child that comes from her that's going to put all this right. He'll hate what he's supposed to hate. He'll hate sin by his nature. Your children, they will love sin by their nature. This child, he will love by his nature. Your children can't love by nature anymore. They're fallen. They're now selfish. But one child is going to come and he's going to do what's supposed to be done. One child. And we all know that that's the very first time that he gives a messianic prophetic introduction. He introduces man to the Messiah, the very first words out of his mouth after they have fallen. But it's one child. It's one child. Paul is doing the same thing here. And by the way, in case you haven't got it, that one child isn't Isaac. This one child is the same one child that God was telling Eve in the garden. This is a messianic prophecy. See, because if not, our Western thought's going to take us right over this. Our Western thought is now always going to look upon that particular group of people, always look at Jews and anybody labeled as Jews, that they're God's chosen people and that they're the only ones. And in a way, yes, at a time, in a way, they were. There was a physical manifestation of the covenant, was there not? But Paul will begin to talk about in Romans saying, look, you know, now it's come to us. And then what happened is that us Gentiles got puffed up and we got cocky and we started saying, you know what, you guys tried to add all this stuff and we have faith in Christ and you have faith in the law. And that division happened for 300 years. And then in the fourth century, it just blew apart. And now all of a sudden it's Jews and it's Christians. It's one tree and it's another tree. Grace, law. And nothing could be further from the truth, and is one of the hugest heresies in all the church. In fact, I think that one of Paul's dying words was to tell the Gentile church, look, quit getting so uppity with him. Don't you understand? Don't you realize? This is one tree, not two trees, one tree in which you've been grafted into. We were lovingly grafted into this tree. We were given Abraham's covenant by the only man who could give it to us. And Paul's saying, and now you want to get uppity with Jews? And that beautiful Calvel Homer argument again, he goes, if you as wild olives were grafted into the domestic tree, how much more will God graft in the domestic olives? So Paul's saying, look, promise, inheritance. My point is this, he says, the law which came 430 years later does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. See, in Western thought, the Mosaic covenant will come after the Abrahamic covenant. Actually, no. Isaac will take a bit of it. Jacob will take a bit of it. And then Moses comes after it. Moses is the part of the covenant that comes 400 years later. Okay, he's saying that didn't nullify the faith on which it was founded. See, what happened to them as a people is the same thing that happens to us. A new revelation from God, and now all of a sudden, this law that Moses brings, it's now the way. And he's saying, no, the Mosaic law did not nullify the faith-based covenant of Abraham. It's still based on faith. The law came as an attempt for a better way for you and me to live. So he said, you know, if we can't nullify a human covenant, then why do you think God would nullify his covenant? See, again, Western thought, new and improved. Even when we begin to name the testaments, the New Testament. Right? For if the inheritance comes from the law, no longer comes from the promise. But God granted it to Abraham through the what? Through the promise. So two new words, promise and what? Inheritance. How do you get an inheritance? How do you get an inheritance? Somebody's got to give it to you. Right? Somebody's got to give it to you. Is there any other way to get it? Nope. Just because you're a son, does that guarantee you your parents' inheritance? No, they still got to give it to you. Right? Where is it written that a child has to get a parent's inheritance? Especially when you don't have one. If you don't have one, then you don't, you know, anyway. But he introduces us to this new word, inheritance. Inheritance. Yes, the covenant was inherited by Isaac, but he said Abram still had to give it to him. Actually, who did Abram want to give it to? He wanted to give it to Ishmael. Right? He wanted to give it to Ishmael. And God had to gently remind him, Abram, it's not your covenant, it's mine. And I've chosen to give it to Isaac. And of course, at that time, Abram went, Isaac who? Who's Isaac? Right? But when God said, no, I'll give you somebody to give the covenant to, because that's what I want. Right? I'll give you somebody to give the covenant to, because that's what I want. And Abram believed that, and it was reckoned to him as what? As righteousness. Paul is trying to tell them, look, just because the law came 430 years later does not mean that it voided and nulled. My name is Webster. I can make up words if I want to. A covenant that was based on faith. That's what he's telling the Galatians. Promise. Inheritance. The distorters have convinced the Galatians that God's promises were only to Abraham and his seed. The Jewish people understood that singular, if you will, as a generic singular. In other words, all the people were made one. And Paul is saying, no, they're viewing it wrong. It actually was one child. And it wasn't Isaac. He comes about 2,000 years later. So some, you know, were taken by that argument. They said, this makes sense. By the way, when I was done with that Bible study that the distorters took the church through last week, how many thought that it made sense? Oh, come on, really? It made perfect sense. In fact, I am convinced that at the end of that Bible study, they actually asked them, does this make sense to you? Does this sound logical to you? I'm laughing because that question is at the end of nearly every Adventist Bible study that's ever been written. Makes sense, doesn't it? Our message has been very logical, and there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. But there are some that took that argument, and it obviously made sense to them because they decide to become circumcised, and they decide to begin to observe laws and diets and feasts and everything else. And by the way, nothing wrong with the laws and the diets and the feasts. It's just that they were trying to complete a covenant of faith by works of the law. And God says, this is an uncompromisable position you've pushed yourself in. Because I'm telling you, I lived that way for most of my life, and I was absolutely lost. You don't please God in the flesh. You please God in faith. How in the world can God be pleased with me if I become a commandment keeper when he already loved me before I became a commandment keeper? The law is, the curse is not in the law itself. The curse is what I'm trying to do with the law, trying to perfect myself with the law, trying to please God with the law. Again, the argument from the greatest to the least. If God is already pleased with you, then why do you think you can please him with your obedience? So this is the argument, he says. Promise, inheritance. What did the son do to deserve the inheritance? Nothing. All he did was be born. And if the father wanted, he doesn't have to give it to the son. But I'm your son, so what? I like your sister better. So the law's got nothing to do with either annulling or adding to. The distorters believe this. Paul says he used to believe this. But he's saying himself. And what's funny is that this one here, this violates the principle I've taught you before of and. Paul actually uses an either-or argument here. Remember I told you before that Hebrew thought is more and? That's why we can have an Old and a New Testament and have the Old Testament not done away with the New, because it's and. Again, fiddler on the roof. All the village elders are arguing, right? Someone says that what's going on in Russia is good, the revolution, if you will. Another one says, I don't think so. Tevye says, I agree with you. Tevye says, I agree with you. And then the other guy says, Tevye, they both had opposing opinions. How can you agree with both? And Tevye looks at him and he goes, you know, you're right too. And. But here Paul uses an either or argument. Either the inheritance comes from the law or it comes from the what? No compromising. No compromising. You want to be part of the Abrahamic covenant, if you will. You've got to do it based on his promise and nothing else. Nothing else. We do it on his promise or we don't do it at all. Do you think we have that argument about the second coming, right? Who can stand? Who can stand? Either we stand by faith or we don't what? Or we don't stand at all. So it's not a way of interpreting the law. It's not a way of applying the law. Nothing. It's not that it comes, the argument comes way, way before. It's either or. It's an argument about faith and nothing else. If we think that we're entering into a covenant of obedience in order to please God, in order to become perfect and to become more like him, Paul says it's not based on the promise anymore. You're heading down a road, a dark road, that Peter actually said, you know what, that none of the children of God have ever been able to carry from Sinai till now. Kal vachomer. Inheritance. Think about his parables. If a worker that works 1 hour gets the same reward as one who works 12, Jesus is saying to the guys that work 12, if I'm willing to give it to a guy that only works one, why wouldn't I give it to you when actually you're the one that I made the covenant with originally? And we all know that the parable of the 12-hour workers is Israel, right? The most obedient, the most religious, they show up first. They get the covenant first. And they agree to work for a day for how much? For a day's wage. The last person that he calls is an hour. The ones that the 12-hour workers look upon and say, "Who?" And we know that they represent the Gentiles, right? We know that they represent the Gentiles. And they come in and all of a sudden they get mad because they think, you know what? If they get it working 1 hour, then we get more. See, and that's what they're trying to tell the Galatians. That's what these people are trying to tell these brand new Christians, is that if you become Jewish, you get more. If you do it our way, you get more. I'm sorry, I wish I could take that back. I don't like that. If you become Jewish. I want to become Jewish. But the only way you can become Jewish is to base your promise on Abraham's faith and our faith and not the works of the law. You do that, you become a true Jew. We're all Jewish, he says. But he says, but what he was saying is they thought that they were sealing the deal. They thought they were perfecting the deal. They were hedging their bets. And what does that say about God, by the way? What it says is, he's not a man of his promise. He's not a God of his promise. I know I said I promised it to you, but I like you a lot better if you will continue to keep the law. We make God a liar, don't we? We insult him. If he would risk harm and limb to go after one lost lamb, then how much more, how much safer, how much sealed is the promise for those who are still in the pen? The church, though, the church sits in the pen and we think we deserve more. We see the lost lamb come back and we feel pretty superior because we never left. But secretly, like the older brother and the prodigal son, we also begin to resent them.